Welcome to the online version of the Pacific Group meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is an open meeting and all members of the community are welcome to join. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics will participate in our meeting. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening, my name is Becky and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Amy L.
Hi, I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Mary, for inviting me to do this. I am sitting in my sponsor's living room while she and my sober sisters are out in the backyard. I just heard them clap for me. Thank you, guys. So I'm feeling surrounded by love and right at home, albeit terribly nervous. There is nothing that makes me feel more alcoholic in sobriety than being asked to do public speaking. And, you know, I had plans to spend this Zoom meeting night with the girls in pajamas, and then I got a call from Mary, and as usual, Pacific Group asks and expects more of me than I feel like I'm capable of. And God, that was annoying at first, but thank you so much. Thank you so much for that gift. Yvonne S. is my sponsor. She asked me to say her name 7 times during this talk. So Yvonne, I love you. You saved my life. My sobriety date is 2/22 of 2015, but that is not my first sobriety date. When I came to Pacific Group, I was dragged by a sponsor who was not in Pacific Group to you because I couldn't stay sober and she didn't know what to do with me. And I had heard a few things about Pacific Group. I was particularly nervous because I was wearing a pair of jeans that had the most holes in them. And, you know, typically scared because I didn't know anyone and that's uncomfortable. And I remember showing up to Monday Night Ohio. And I remember where I sat and I remember what I thought. And what I thought was, these people look good. These people look clean and happy and put together. And when you got up to the podium, you talked about solution and you talked about a higher power and you talked about the steps and you talked about actions. And that was different than the meetings I had been going to for years prior all over the LA area trying to stay sober. And honestly, it at first I felt like, oh no, these can't be my people. I'm miserable. I don't hear anybody speaking about how miserable they are, you know? I hate myself. I know I can never stay sober. I don't believe in God, and I've already tried and failed, you know? I'm worthless, and I wasn't hearing that. That's not because it wasn't there. It's just because I felt different, and I was looking for the differences. But, you know, if you knew me back then, the girl that walked into that Pacific Group meeting became the girl who I fell in love with Pacific Group. You guys were going camping and you guys were putting on plays, which was nerdy but also fun, and you were helping each other, you know, outside of meetings and celebrating each other outside of meetings. And that was attractive to me. I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to play volleyball with you and to go to Joshua Tree and climb rocks with you. And I wanted to be a part of. It was very attractive. And so I stuck around, but I was the girl who was pretty much in the middle of Pacific Group, showing up an hour early to every meeting. I got a Pacific Group sponsor. I got all the commitments. I started going to all the things. But every, you know, 6 months, 8 months, I would raise my hand again. You know, I'm new again. And every time it felt a little harder because we're such a tight-knit group. And I felt embarrassed and exposed. And so if you are new tonight and or you identify as a chronic relapser, you are in my heart. My heart belongs to the chronic relapsers. I know that feeling of it's working for you guys, but it won't work for me. The only thing I did right was keep showing up in spite of that feeling, right? So I'm an alcoholic of the anxious and depressive variety. You know, when I was 3 years old, I would complain to my mother that I have the funny feeling. I have the funny feeling. It lives in my chest. I feel it right now, you know, when asked to speak to you. I was incredibly shy. Now I call it self-obsession because it's basically the same thing. And the book talks about it and what to do about it. And I'm grateful. But I was just a scared little kid that had every reason to succeed. And, you know, parents that worked in the psychology field and are still married and are super loving. And I had everything. I had a lot of potential. But I didn't feel right. And after not feeling right for long enough, I started not acting right. And, you know, it took me a long time. I mean, I started drinking in high school like everyone else. And then I discovered hard drugs towards the end of high school and in college. And then after barely graduating college, I spent about 10 years lonelier and lonelier, spending all my money on drugs and booze and breaking the hearts of everyone that loved me. And it took me a long time to consider that I might be an alcoholic. I knew I was a drug addict, but I thought, you know, if I just wasn't so depressed, I wouldn't drink and use the way I do. But, you know, again, I'm the type of alcoholic that goes into my mother's medicine cabinet and empties out all of her pills, pours them into my mouth and puts the capsules back in the cabinet so that, you know, she, so that she'll take them anyway and wonder why they're not working and be in pain. And I'm the type of alcoholic that manipulates my dad because he's a sweet guy and a psychiatrist, you know, into prescribing me something that I need, like, you know, cough syrup with codeine, because what he doesn't know is I've been on I've been up for 2 weeks. There's no alcohol in the house and I need something to take the edge off. And I'm the type of alcoholic that falls through a skylight at a rooftop party when I'm visiting my family, you know, with my sister. And, you know, my sister can't find me. And she hears that Amy fell off the roof, when really what she heard was Amy fell on the roof. But, you know, for 10 minutes, she thought I had fallen off a 12-story building. And like usual, she was going to have to find me, figure out what to do and take care of it. And, you know, the first love of my life broke up with me because who was an alcoholic, by the way, the first alcoholic I ever met, because he left me because I couldn't stop lying, you know, and I felt like, God, you're an alcoholic, you know, like I'm not the problem. Anyways, I moved to LA to take a rest. I didn't know I was coming here to get sober, but my higher power did. And I landed in the best place ever to be sober and young, and have fun doing it. I was in and out of outpatient treatment. I couldn't seem to get it right. And I tried a lot of meetings until I found you. And like I said, the only thing I did right was keep coming back. Literally the only thing. It's a miracle that I can speak in front of you, that I would be asked to speak at a Pacific group meeting. I respect the hell out of you guys. You know, now with 6 years sober and some amazing female friends and an amazing fiance who's also sober, who I met here, and a dog that I adore, and just the gift of being able to sponsor other women. You know, me, I don't have anything to offer but my experience, and suddenly that's of value. And I've learned how to like myself here, and I owe it all to you. So thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you, Amy. Our second 10-minute speaker is Norman L.
Hello, Zoom world. My name is Norman, and I'm an alcoholic. Amy, thank you for your share. And Mary, thank you for asking me to share. And a big shout out to the class of 88. My sobriety date is September 20th, 1988. We're going to have a big banquet on Saturday, so be there or be square. Anyway, I got to this group almost 33 years ago. My sobriety date, about a month after my sobriety, I found the Pacific group. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. First, I just have to say that I'm a high bottom drunk. I come to you from a 5-bedroom house. I don't remember how many bathrooms, probably 3, swimming pool, jacuzzi, 3 beautiful daughters and a beautiful wife and a successful business. And I drank every single day and could not stop drinking. So it's not about, this is a spiritual program. I was spiritually bankrupt, and I have no idea how I got sober. It kind of just happened. I was a bar drinker. I drank every single day. Like I said, I drank, if I went to a party, I better know where your booze is in the house. I drank before I got to the party. I remember just a little bit to qualify, my ex-wife was a travel agent, and we went on a Panama Canal cruise. It was like a 15-day cruise, and the first stop was St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, and I bought a case of booze to take home with me, and I drank that whole case of booze myself, plus more alcohol on the cruise ship, of course, in that cruise. And of course I drank in blackouts, you know, unbelievable. I don't remember a third of what I did out there. And I made amends to those, what I remembered, but I remember waking up in a closet in Mexico because I went to a quinceañera, and who knows what I did. So I drank every single day. I drank in my little Chinese restaurant called Paul's Kitchen in Monterey Park. And I'll tell you a little bit about my, hopefully was my last day of drinking, September 17th, 1988. I had I woke up in that big, beautiful house and jumped in the shower and, washed those cobwebs out of my eyes from the drinking the day before. And I said, I'm not going to drink today on self-will. I'm just not going to drink. I had every intention of that day of not drinking. So I got to my job. Oh, my ex-wife said, come home because I'm making dinner. And she didn't make dinner every night because she's a hardworking school teacher. And I said, okay, I'll be home at 6 o'clock or whatever. And at 11 o'clock that morning, I was at the front door of that Chinese restaurant bar as a guy opened up that front door. And I went in the bar and started drinking. I had the seat right on the corner. If anybody remembers the television show Cheers, there was a guy in the first seat. His name was Norm. Nobody sat there. Well, my name used to be Norm. Now I changed it to Norman. Anyway, I sat there and had I drank my lunch away, went back to my office. I had employees. I think I probably crashed in my car outside of my office because I was too drunk to be at work. At the end of the day, instead of going straight home, I went back to that bar, had a few more drinks, and then proceeded to alcoholically drive home. I had a system of driving home from Monterey Park to Whittier. I did not get on the freeway. I went down all the side streets, back alleys. In those days, there wasn't much traffic, so I couldn't drive 25 miles on the freeway with no traffic. It was a bust. So I went down all the back alleys, and I was holding my hand on the seat so I wouldn't keel over, and one hand over the eye so I could see one line down the road. And I got home to that big, beautiful house with the three beautiful children. And I made myself what I hope was the last drink. It was a vodka and grapefruit juice. And I remember lying in my den, half of it going in my mouth and the other half going on my shirt. And my 11-year-old daughter at the time, Melody, she's my angel, she came in and said, "Dad, if you keep drinking, you're going to kill yourself." And I don't know where 11-year-old kid came up with that, but I poured that drink out. And she also said, if you keep smoking, you're going to kill yourself. So I threw away that pack of Marlboro box, but I started smoking again. So I was lost. I was lost without my friend alcohol. I couldn't function without alcohol. And here it is, no drinking for me. It's gone. So luckily I had this friend, his name is Bruce, and he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a year. And I thought he was a worse drunk than me. He crashed on the freeway, fell asleep, and crashed his car, got all, you know, had to go to the hospital, all kinds of, you know, stitches and broken this and broken that. And this guy was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Norman, I'll take you to meetings." So he took me to meetings for a week. And I was desperate because I lost my best friend, alcohol. And what was I going to do? Of course, there was nothing in my house because I drank every single drop that I ever had. I even drank cream de menthe when I got desperate. I mean, there was nothing in my house. And I knew I couldn't drink. So I just kept going to these meetings. He took me for a week. In fact, he even took me to the Pacific Group meeting. And I just kept going and didn't get a sponsor or anything. I thought some of these people at some of these meetings weren't too friendly. And then I ran into this guy and at some small meeting in Whittier or Pasadena. I don't remember where it was. And he came up, shook my hand. Said, "How you doing?" And I was kind of, he was a young kid. He was probably about 25. I mean, I was 38 when I got sober. And I go, "Where do you go to meetings?" And he circled all these meetings on the West Side. And they were the Pacific Group meetings. And I don't know if this guy's still, I didn't see him at the meetings after a year or so. And I just kept going to the Pacific Group meetings because the people were friendly. And they were also annoying. They would not leave me alone. "Do you have a sponsor? Do you have a sponsor?" I don't even know what a sponsor is. "Well, here's a pamphlet. Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor." It was on and on and on for a week or two, and I couldn't take it anymore. So some guy who is probably drunk now or whatever, he just pointed to this guy, "Get him." And it was Tom Hoy. And I had nothing in common with this guy. He was a big, tough bouncer from a bar. He killed somebody in a bar and was in a chain gang. And this man saved my life. He told me what to do, go to meetings, get commitments. We worked the steps. And I had terrible, terrible issues in my life. And it all came to a head in my first year of sobriety. I can't get into too much details in 10 minutes. Three things happened. One, my wife threw me out of the house and wanted a divorce and moved some guy in the house. Two, I was losing my business to redevelopment, and it was a very successful business. And three, my father was dying of leukemia, and I hated his guts and wanted to kill him. So I had all these things happen to me in my first year. I had these tremendous resentments. I was torn up inside. I couldn't work anymore. My sponsor said, close the shop, go and take a walk, call. I called people constantly during the day because I learned to do that in sobriety. I learned to do that when things were going good. I had a real good connection. So just because you're sober doesn't mean everything's going to be wonderful. My life is wonderful now. Right now, I'm living the dream. I'm playing golf 5 times a week. I mean, Dave's driving me crazy with this golf. I don't know if I can take it much longer. I'm 71 years old. But anyway, I was forced to work the steps. I only have a minute left. I'm telling you, I worked a thorough 4th step and a 5th step with my sponsor. I made amends to my dying father and in the hospice, and my life completely changed. It completely changed. And what's keeping me sober now is I sponsor about 7 guys. I continue to go to meetings. I keep doing what worked for me for the last 33 years. If you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor, you know, and go to meetings, read the book. Your life will change. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Norman. Our main speaker tonight is Denny S.
Hi, everybody. My name is Denny. I am an alcoholic. That's the best news I got for you right there. That's the best. I'm just thrilled to be here. I'm so comfortable with you folks. I'm not a member of this group, but I've spoken there several times, and I know so many. I see so many friends. I don't want to start, but Sharon and Charlie and Bob, and there's a whole ton of people on here that I just know and I love so much, and I'm so grateful for my sobriety. I'm grateful to AA, God first, AA and rooms like you. I mean, this is I'll tell you, Norman, I love you, Norman. We played golf for years. We played every Friday morning with my sponsor, and I miss seeing you. I've got a little breathing problem that's going on right now, and I haven't been able to play, and I really miss it. But I made a deal with God. He's going to pull me through this, too. Let me see. Oh, and I love Amy. Your 10-minute talk was really wonderful, too. That's my meeting, you know, because now I'm just flapping my jaw. It's not a meeting anymore when you're talking, you know. But, you know, Norman reminded me of what the drinking was like. And in 1979, I was going on a concert tour to Australia, and I was taking a night flight over there, and I came out of a blackout, peeing ups against the window in the first-class kitchen. I think I might have known that I was an alcoholic there. But it took another 12 years to find Alcoholics Anonymous. So God bless, I'm here. January the 2nd, 1991 is my sobriety date. I just turned, January. Yeah, I'm coming up on 31 now. I'm almost an old timer. But it's just really great to be have this program handed to me on a silver platter by a gentleman named Scott Redmond, who was my original sponsor. God bless him. And there's only one person happier than I am, that I'm sober, and that's my wife. poor thing. She's French. She doesn't know any better. Next month, this Thanksgiving, we celebrate 55 years of wedded bliss, of marriage, you know, 55, like that's unheard of. So when you hear people say that drummers can't stay married, wrong, wrong. And the only thing that kept me in the ring with this relationship is this beautiful program, you know, and the sponsor I have now is a member of your group, Steve A, who I just adore this man. He changed my life. What can I say? And when you have guys like Steve and Father Terry in your corner, anything is possible. Let me see. I'm getting kvetched already, or whatever that word is. You know, I just get so grateful. And I haven't done this. You know, this get up that I have on. I don't dress like this every day, but this getup, I mean, the last time I wore it was 2 years ago when I was asked to speak at Founders Day in Akron on a Friday night. It was the small meeting, the little meeting. There's only 5,000 people there. But so I'm blessed with this program and the fact that I get to do stuff like this. It just, I can never say or repay AA for the life that I got here, you know, so forever grateful. Let me start in the beginning. I think I got here through an accident of some kind, you know. You know how they talk about resentment, and Norman talked about it, Amy talked about it. All you newcomers, I want to welcome you to the best deal you'll ever find. And, you know, you're going to hear this, there's going to be a lot of talk about resentment and the fourth step. And I want to start off by saying, it's no big deal. Like, if you don't want to do it, just don't do it. It's only vital, crucial, and infinitely grave that you do it. If you don't do it, you are sure to drink and to die. All right, I got that out of the way. So, you know, I got here after those many, many years of drinking because I was in a situation and I was working in a band in England that should have taken care of us financially the rest of our lives. And what I didn't know when I went into this arrangement with this guy that I was working with is that I had an alcoholic brain. And if you're new, you probably have an alcoholic brain. We're going to ask you to not use it for a little while, okay? Just give us a chance at it. You know, give us a shot. We want to just warp it and bend it around a little bit so it starts thinking a little clearer, you know? So I had this alcoholic brain, and I had this incredible opportunity to go work with this guy in London, and it should have taken care of our financial needs the rest of our lives. And we made an agreement on a hippie handshake. That was my first mistake, you know, of listening to the alcoholic brain. And so, you know, I had a lot of fun with drugs and alcohol during those times, you know, because as you can see, I'm in my music studio here, and this is where I almost live in here, you know, but it's part of that world. It was especially part of that world when I was in it as deeply as I was at that time. But I didn't know that alcoholism was really starting to rear its ugly head in so many ways. And what happened was this hippie handshake, that we're in a situation now where there's millions of dollars floating around with huge concert tours, and records are going off the charts, and selling millions of records, and all this money is flying around, and it's my share isn't coming down. And I didn't know what to do. I still don't know what to do about a lot of things, but that really had me baffled. And so, you know, I stuck it out because it was so much fun in some ways, but I knew that there was something very, very wrong with it. And finally, I listened to the alcoholic brain again. And what the alcoholic brain told me to do was, well, why don't you just leave? You're a session guy in New York. You did really well in New York. You don't need this band. You don't need to stick this out and wait for things to clear up and get better. Why don't you just leave? And I did. I did. I listened to that alcoholic brain one more time. And there was a car in front of our apartment in London and take us to the airport to fly off to Lagos, Nigeria to make his most successful record. We rehearsed it all up and we were ready to go. And the alcoholic brain just shouted so loud. It said, leave, get out of here. And I picked up the phone and I called my boss and my bandmate, not a boss, but I called him up and I said, I can't do this anymore. And I'm leaving now. And I hung that phone up. And that day that I made that phone call, I think I gave birth to my alcoholism. I'd given birth to my first resentment, and it was a doozy. It lasted 28 years. So every drink that I took after that was no longer, there was nothing fun about it. Nothing fun. I was drinking at him. I'll show you. I'll kill myself slowly. And that's the brilliant mind of the alcoholic. I'll kill myself, but slowly, you know, really, really want to enjoy this. And so I started that nasty drinking that a lot of us know about. And it lasted for years. I don't know how my wife stuck it out. I was just, all I could do was get up and go to a bar and drink. I didn't want to feel anything by noon. You know, by noon I wanted to have Stolies and cognac and just be numb to the world. It was no way to live. And I kind of got the idea. I said, well, this is not normal. This is really not normal. Why don't I see what my doctor has to say about this? So I had a doctor, excuse me, his name is Ralph, and he played the string bass. You know, I trust other musician doctors because I'll tell them the truth. I won't tell a regular doctor any truth. So anyway, my buddy Ralph said, well, you know, I said, I have a problem with alcohol. And he says, if you truly have a problem with alcohol, there's only one thing that works, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what else you got? You know, come on, I lived in France. I can't, come on. Alcoholics Anonymous already? Isn't that a little severe? So anyway, I tried acupuncture. That didn't work. Started drinking again. So I said, well, maybe there's something. How about hypnosis? So now I try a little hypnosis. And, you know, you start feeling better about yourself. Then the disease starts talking to you. Come on. You can do it again. You can do it again. It'll be different this time. After a while, it's relentless. It just keeps at you. It keeps at you and it keeps at you. And this disease, it's not a pretty disease until you catch it. But in the beginning, it wants you in the gutter with its foot on your neck, squeezing the life out of you in front of everyone that loves you. And today, if I didn't have that disease, I wouldn't be the happy man that you see in front of you. I mean, this disease, it is a killer. But I love, Dr. Paul was my grand sponsor I got very close to him the last 5-10 years of his life. And Dr. Paul always just said, I hope you catch a good case of alcoholism, because it's the only disease known to mankind. When you catch it, you become a better person. And that's what it was for me. I became a better person. I started treating the world like I wanted the world to treat me. But anyway, I came into the program. I came in with a buddy of mine that I used to drink with, a little comedian. And I said, we drank in the same bar, and he drank red wine, pineapple juice, and coffee. Red wine for the buzz, pineapple juice to stay healthy, coffee to stay awake. His name was Sandy. God bless him. He was my Eskimo. So I saw that Sandy just left the red wine out. He had pineapple juice and coffee. He was at the bar hanging out. But I said, what's going on? He said, I started going to AA. And I went, I remember Dr. Ralph mentioned AA. So I said, well, I'm going to watch him for a while, and then I'll ask him to take me to one of those meetings. And the first meeting he took me to was a Comedy Store, of course. And I walked into the Comedy Store. So you'll feel right at home. It stinks of stale beer and cigarettes from the night before. You'll feel right at home. And he was right. I came in and I felt home. I was at home. I listened to a speaker he was a friend of mine. I didn't know he was sober. He was sober 5 years. He was leading the meeting. And he told a story that I related with. Like we related at these meetings, we hear this great information that comes from the heart, not from the head. And I loved that meeting. It was only once a week. And I started going to that meeting every Wednesday at 5 o'clock. It was a rush hour meeting. I got a food commitment and I brought food. And I brought, you know, I was just there every week. And I stopped drinking. For 3 months, I stopped drinking, which was a miracle in and of itself. But I didn't know that you had to stop everything. So I was kind of on that marijuana maintenance thing where I'd smoke a joint on the way in and have one roll for the way out. It just made the speakers a whole lot funnier. But during those 3 months of going to that one meeting a week, I heard it's everything from the neck up. So I knew I had to start all over again. But I'd already, I don't I don't recommend this as a method of detox, but I think the weed actually helped me, you know, made it a little bit easier to quit drinking. And so I got through those 3 months, and then that was in September. So it was January. It was New Year's Eve. And I said, I'm going to work this. I'm going to do this thing. I've never been sober, completely sober all my life. So, and even though I didn't have alcoholism in my family, nobody drank that. I'd still fooled around with a lot of substances in all those years. And I said, I'm going to work with the band New Year's Eve, and I'm going to blow it all out. I'm going to get sober the following 2 days later, January 2nd, because it was my grandmother's birthday. And I loved my grandmother. We had a very special bond. So New Year's Eve, I worked with the band. Now, I quit drinking in September, working with the band New Year's Eve. I had a cigarette pack with 20 joints rolled up in it. I had a 2-gram vial of blow, and I had a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne because I wasn't drinking, damn it. So I got through that night, and I licked my wounds the next day. And then I started going to a lot of meetings, 3, 4, sometimes 5 meetings a day. I couldn't be alone with myself. So I went to the Chandler Lodge to get sober because that's all I knew about at the time. So I used to go to the 9 a.m. and then the noon and then the 6 o'clock and sometimes the night meeting. I just couldn't be alone with me. And then I heard about the Radford Lodge, and I started going over to the Radford Lodge. I was enjoying sobriety. I was enjoying that it was so easy to not drink and do all of that other outside issues stuff. I didn't have to do anything except get up and go into a room with a lot of happy people and drink coffee and listen to them share about their lives. It really seduced me in the most serene way. Then I started seeing that some guys weren't sticking around. You know, I was 47 years old when I got sober. So I thought, geez, if I miss this thing and I go out, I might never find it again. I better start listening up. What's keeping guys from staying? And then I heard it was this fourth step, you know? And then there was an old timer, God bless, Marty Warner. A lot of you knew Marty. He was a great guy over here in the Valley. He got up in my face one day and he said, "Hey kid, you won't do a fourth step. You'll drink before you do a fourth step." I said, thank God I'm a retaliator. That's what I found out doing these steps. One of my character defects, I'm a retaliator. So I had to tell this guy, you know, show this guy that I'm going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to do a four step. And I had got Scott Redman as my sponsor at the, I was 29 days sober, was up at the Universal Amphitheater when they were having the San Fernando Valley's convention. And I had my eye on Scott as a sponsor, and I asked him that day, and we started working together. So now he said, "Look, I'll be your sponsor, but this is what you need to do: call me every day for 7 days. If you miss a day, we start all over again, okay? And we'll talk, we'll get to know each other, we'll get the ball rolling." I said, "Great, let's do that." So I made the 7 mandatory days. We got to know each other, and then I said, "I think I need to do this fourth step because guys are telling me I won't do it. I'll drink." And he said, "Perfect timing." So he invited me up to the house. And, you know, I think that's the day that my alcoholism just, like, my recovery started. It was one drunk at the kitchen table talking to another drunk. Pot of coffee. Big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the miracle around here. That's the miracle around here. One drunk talking to another one. Now, if you see one drunk talking around, sitting around talking to himself, give him a hand. He needs help. So Scott read me chapter 5, just the way we read it at most meetings. He said, "Stop me if you need to talk about something." I said, "Very good." So I'd heard it enough that it made sense to me at that time. Incidentally, if you don't know how it works, it's in chapter 5. It's called How It Works. So anyway, he read me this chapter, and we got to page 83, where it says, "Are you ready to take that third step formally?" And I said, "Damn right I am." He said, "I think you are too." So we got on our knees and we locked arms, and I took my third step formally. So for me, that third step was much deeper than that hippie handshake. That third step covered everything that was wrong with me. I've got a disease motivated by self and fear. When I'm not thinking about myself, I'm thinking about myself. And I'm afraid of everything. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, fancied or real. If I don't have a real one, I'll just make one up. So, man, this is like all coming. Oh, I get off my knees after taking, well, the third step prayer. First of all, let me tell you why it was hippie deep. I mean, hippie deep indeed. I mean, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me the bondage of self. Take away my difficulties. That victory over them, I bear witness to somebody else I can help, you know? Oh my God, I got off my knees and it was like something hit me. A bolt of lightning said, you'll never have to take a drink again. You'll never have to take a drink again. It was like my nightmare is over. I'm not a slave to this anymore. It was amazing. It was amazing. Then we sat down. He said, all right, I want you to get some paper. I want you to draw some lines on paper. I'm going to show this inventory process that we do. We're going to make three lists, a resentment list, fear list, and a sexual inventory. So he says, get a piece of paper out, draw a line across the top, one down each side, and write resentments at the top. And I did. He said, okay, now in the first column, we're going to label that I'm resentful at. The second column, which is the larger column in the middle, he said, the cause of the resentment. The third column was, this affects my. So I said, where's he going with all of this? You know, I could not have figured this out on my own, believe me. So he said, what about that guy from England that screwed you out of all that money? Are you resentful at him? I said, yeah. He said, good, put his name in there. I'm resentful at, boom, put the man's name in. He said, now what's the cause of the resentment? I said, the resentment was he promised me pay for work. I worked, he didn't pay. Great, nice and succinct, clear. So we put that in the middle column. Now he said, now how did you have that resentment? How did it affect you? I said, what are you talking about? He said, look on the bottom of page 64. On the bottom of page 64, it says, when we're in this phase of resentment, it affects our self-esteem, our pocketbook, our ambition, our personal relationships, and our sex. Did it affect your self-esteem? Yeah, I thought I was a loser. Did it affect your pocketbook? Were you listening? Did it affect your ambition? Yeah, the next band, I'm going to get screwed again. Did it affect your personal relationships? Yeah, especially with him. I couldn't say this man's name without MF at the end of it. Then he said, did it affect your sex? I think everything does. He said, great, you got a fire bagger there. So just think of it. Excuse me. When your self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relationship, and sex are tied up on a resentment, you're kind of busy. You're kind of busy. There's no time for fun. So I've got that down. That's my first one. Now he said, here comes the good part. I want you to turn that page over. And on the top, I want you to write, now what is the fault in Denny that if God would come along and remove it, he would no longer have this resentment? I said, wait a minute, fault in me. I was doing really well until I left New York and went to work for this. He said, we're not taking his inventory. This is you're the drunk here. We want you to be tough on yourself from an entirely different angle. So I went, okay, I'm working with this guy for years with a hippie handshake, and there's a lot of money. I don't have a contract. I guess that would make me irresponsible. There you go. There's my first character defects. So I was irresponsible. Here comes the next one, because I was afraid. Fear of confrontation. Good old FOC, I call it. So fear of confrontation, afraid to do something about it. Oh, well, I know what to do. The alcoholic brain kicks in and says, just freeze them right out of your life. Go to silent scorn. Now I got silent scorn working for me. Scorn is not good. Alcoholics don't do well with scorn. Now I said, well, why don't I start messing with them a little bit while I'm in here? why don't I go to emotional blackmail and just start really messing with them? Now I go to emotional blackmail, and pretty soon it's character assassination. Now I'm on a roll. So I do one damn entry into my resentment inventory. I'm learning so much about myself. I can't believe what I'm learning about myself. So anyway, I went back to, it took me, I don't know, 5 or 8 months. I don't remember how long it was, but I hammered away at that thing every time I made an entry into that fourth step, I just felt great. And something beautiful always happened, you know? So I did my fear inventory, I love on 67 and 8, where it talks about the fear, we're driven by 100 forms of fear. It says, when we ask God to remove these fears, here's my favorite line in the big book. Immediately, we commence to outgrow the fear. Immediately. All we have to do is, Father, please remove this horrible fear of and turn my attention as to what you would have me do or be instead. Immediately, we commence to outgrow the fear. So that was all good news. And I had to do, so the fear inventory, that was real easy. Just everything. Just write it down. You're afraid of everything. And then the sexual inventory, it's wonderful because it just asks these questions. Where am I selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? How could I have unjustifiably aroused suspicion, bitterness, or jealousy? Where am I selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Dishonest? Didn't tell her I was married. Inconsiderate? I didn't care what anybody felt like in the morning when they got up. You know, how could I have unjustifiably have aroused suspicion, bitterness, or jealousy? My wife knew that when I went on a concert tour and had a drink after the show, anything was capable. So I had to put all of that horrible stuff down. Why? I want to take my resentments, my fears, and unsolvable sexual problems, ball them up, and hand them off to God. Keep my damn hands off them. And that's what I learned how to do from the people that showed me how to do this, especially Scott. It was just, you know, so I don't know. I did my 5, 8 months, whatever it was, and I called Scott up again. I'm ready to read my fifth step. We got on our knees. We brought God into the room with the third step prayer. And I read him my inventory. He said, you know, we laughed, we cried. He fell asleep a few times, you know. He said, sounds like you had an interesting time out there. And, you know, I went home and I did 6 and 7 and I studied my character defects and I asked God. That's it. I mean, when you know what's wrong with you, then you've got dialogue to go that 800 number straight to your higher power. And I had, as long as I'm in recovery when I'm asking God for God's help. And so I went about my amends. I went home to Pennsylvania to where I'm come from Eastern Pennsylvania. And I had a church family that, I want to rush through a little bit, but I went back there to make amends to my family. My mom was a church secretary, my father a deacon, my grandfather an elder, my sister, brother, and grandmother all sang on the church choir. And the best I could do with 13 years of perfect attendance was steal money out of the collection plate. You know, I found out that if I got that gig of taking the Sunday school's seven traditions, I can go down to the church office and count it up and miss half of the damn thing and then go sit with my granddad in the back of the church for the church service. And sometimes I'd steal a quarter and go across the street in the drugstore and have a smoke and a Coke and wait for the Sunday school to be over. So I just had to sit through one service. So I had to go back and I had to make amends for that. I went to that church and I had to put a big bill in that plate when it came around, you know, without a note saying, I'm an AA now and I have to do this. No, I didn't have to do nothing. Just put some money in there. And then after the church service, I went up to the cemetery. My dad and my grandparents were buried in our family plot. I stood there and wept like a baby. What had I done with this beautiful life over a beverage? I was so ashamed. Yeah. So came back. And now I get real busy in AA. Started being asked to speak and sponsoring men. And to this day, I mean, I sponsor as many men as ask me, you know. And I just came from a sponsee meeting that I was having before I came on here, where I just had my guys. And it's what keeps me going. It's what keeps me sober. So I had to make amends to that guy in England too. And I used to talk to Dr. Paul about this. And I'd say, you know, this is really going to be hard because when I make amends to that guy, I have to make amends for the way I left the band and not ask for the check. And he said, yeah, I get it. So I made a deal with God on his suggestion. I made a deal with God. I said, just don't let me drink again. And I don't care if I never see a penny from that, from those years that I was abroad doing that band. I'm happy without it. Then one day I turn on the television and I see that this man, my old bandmate, his wife passed away from breast cancer. And I went, oh my God. And now I had made a couple of attempts. This guy's huge. I had sent him a couple of letters trying to make amends and stuff, but you never really know that I want direct amends, something this profound. So anyway, I see that he loses his wife and I pick up the phone. I had no idea that I was even capable of doing. I pick up the phone and I said, I'm so sorry. And we talk. And we got invited to a memorial that he was having for his wife in New York City. And so we flew in and thinking they wouldn't even know we're there. I'm doing it for my amends. And we were ushered in and we were set right up in the front. After the service, we had a long talk with the whole family, all the kids and everything were there. It was beautiful. And a couple months later, we went over to, I knew that my amends were understood and accepted. So a couple of months later, we went over to see how he was doing without his long-term time partner. And while we were there, he said, those early days when we started that band together, they were very special. And we're going to make a documentary and reissue all of that music and make a film out of it. And I went, oh, that's awesome. What can I do to help? Did I just say that? And he said, yeah, well, didn't you have a little video camera backstage filming all that goofy stuff in the dressing room? I said, yeah. He said, do you still have it? I said, yeah. He said, can we use it in the film? I said, of course. Send it to him. So he sends me a check. A little one, but it's a little check, I didn't have to. So anyway, what does that mean? One more minute? I'll squeeze it in. All right. So he sends me this little check. And I said, wow, this is just awesome. So now I hear that this thing is going to really do well. And I said to my buddy at the record company, I said, what's it going to sell? He says, we're not sure, but we're shipping 2 million units tomorrow. And I said, oh, no, I can't watch this money go by again. So this time I got a new sponsor too. Scott had passed away. I had a different sponsor for the moment. He said, write a letter to him. I said, I can't. So I did. I followed sponsor direction. I wrote a letter. I got all the ugliness out of the first 15 drafts. So I just told him what I needed to say to him and sent it off. I said, I read it to my sponsor first. If you're ever going to do an amends letter, read it to your sponsor, then talk to God about it. I got the okay on both and sent it off. And I know that the man, my buddy, my friend, opened the letter, read it, picked up the phone and called me in tears. He said, Denny, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. I had no idea my business people rolled over you the way they did. And we talked and we talked and we talked. And at the end of that conversation, he said, how did you live with this for 28 years? I said, well, I'm in AA for Christ's sake. And he said, I'm going to make this right. And he made it right. I gave him a chance to make amends. And so, talk about a guy that, no wonder they say we are building an archway through which to pass a free man. No wonder. You can't buy this kind of stuff. You cannot. I can't say thank you enough to the life that I got here. The life that I came with and the life that I had now. Wow. I it'd be great to see Bill and Bob now watching us on these Zooms. Oh my God. If they only had the slightest idea that this was possible in the future. We alcoholics, we're built for this damn pandemic. We're made for it. We're getting through it. It's almost over. We have hope and we have our higher power. And I have you. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Denny. May we have the announcements from our secretary?
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. So we celebrate birthdays at this meeting for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate number of candles. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. So if you're a regular attender of the meeting and would like to take a cake with us, normally you would send your photo and everything on Zoom to Kimberly K at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon on Wednesday. And we do have some Zoom birthdays. And also we have, first, before we show the birthdays, we're going to have a happy birthday song. Toby just came in with his guitar and got dressed, and he's going to sing happy birthday before we move on. Okay, Toby.
Yeah, it's a real special treat for you folks tonight. Happy birthday, alcoholics. Denny S. opened for me tonight. That's wild. Go, A.A., it's your birthday. We going to party like it's your birthday. Drink coffee like it's your birthday. Go, A.A. Go, A.A., it's your birthday. We going to party like it's your birthday. Drink coffee like it's your birthday. Go, A.A. Keep coming back.
Very good, Toby. Very good. I didn't know you were going to do that. That was great. Denny, pay attention to that now. Okay, so if you, we have a custom to donate $1 for each candle on our cake, and these are the contributions we make to AA organizations worldwide. And we have three Zoom birthdays tonight, so I am going to announce them. So our Zoom birthday is 1-8 years for Andrew C., and his sponsor is Sean C., and 18 years for Christina E., and her sponsor is Joyce F., and 32 years for Maya M., and her sponsor is Sharon C. So thank you very much.